Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC. ESG is about more than ticking boxes. It's about making your climate actions count. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour as we look at some of the major stories making the news in business and politics here in Ireland and around the world. Coming up, with the UK elections entering their final days, I'm going to be joined by Will Hutton. He's an opinion writer for The Observer and former editor-in-chief of that paper, and he's going to be telling us what we might expect from the elections next week. And then I'm going to be exploring the crucial issue of achieving gender parity in the workplace. It's a big issue for sure for women empowerment in the workplace, but it's also something that has significant implications for powering our economy. Sue Duke from LinkedIn is going to be with me in studio to provide insights. And finally, we'll be delving into the challenges facing Jack Chambers, the new Minister for Finance, as he takes up one of the most pressurised roles in government. Cliff Taylor of the Irish Times will be here to take us through what's in his in tray. You can email me at takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. Now, first up today, I'm delighted to be joined in studio by Sue Duke, who is the country lead for Ireland with LinkedIn. Now, in many ways, Sue is the exception to a very depressing rule because according to data that featured in the World Economic Forum's latest report on the global gender pay gap, the percentage of women in senior positions actually fell by 1% from 38% to 37% last year. Now, in Ireland, we do sort of book that trend a little bit. So I've asked Sue to come in here today because she's been writing about it recently in the Irish Times. And we're going to chat about why that is and what we could do maybe to change the statistics. So Sue, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, Sue, first of all, before we get into the figures, maybe take us through some of the findings in this survey and what role LinkedIn had in compiling the data.
That's right, Mandy. We're very fortunate at LinkedIn that with over a billion members across the world, we have a very unique window into the world of work. And one of the things that we can see very clearly is how men and women are faring in the workforce, how their careers are diverging, and pinpointing some of the areas where women are succeeding in advancing their careers at the same rate as men and areas where they're not. And the findings that you're citing are coming directly from the annual World Economic Forum Global Gender Gap Report. That's a seminal annual report that looks at how gender is faring in the workplace and more broadly. And you're right, the top line out of that report, it's quite a sobering read. That report finds that we're fully five generations out at the current trajectory from overall gender equity. And specifically when it comes to what LinkedIn has contributed to that report, what we see very clearly is that when there are systemic setbacks, when there are shocks to the system, like an economic downturn that we've had recently, what we see very clearly is that it is women who take the biggest hit. And most, or directly to your question, most acutely what we have seen over the past couple of years is that despite the progress that women made in getting into leadership roles during the hiring frenzy that we saw throughout the pandemic, over the past couple of years, as the economy has slowed down, as economic uncertainty has taken hold, we have seen that progress not only stall, but be reversed. Mm. And that means that when we take a big step back and look at what progress have we made over the past 6 years, women's representation in senior leadership roles in the workplace has increased less than 1%. Mm. So whilst there has been some progress, it is stalling and we have a long way to go to get to equity.
There's so much in that, like, that we could talk about. First of all, that LinkedIn can gather this data and juxtapose it against what's happening in social or economic cycles is really interesting. Sometimes I think we think of data as like it's a bad thing, you know, but the platform itself has changed a lot, you know, since its initial inception. So that's really useful. The second thing is, yeah, I mean, looking at the figures, you can't but say that there's no lack of will to make things better, right? Policymakers want to make things better. They do. And that's changed since you and I started in the workforce, you know, so there's that will there. It's just that, as you say, things are not progressing at all. I mean, for instance, I was looking at the Irish figures. Women make up 47% of all entry-level roles. And then when you get down to the C-suite, it's just 25%. What happens in that middle bit that drives women out of the workforce?
You're spot on. It's exactly at that middle bit where we see this big drop, this seniority slump, as we call it. So if you take a step back, when we look at the overall, that billion members across the world that LinkedIn has, at entry level, we're roughly at parity. So women hold about 47% of entry level roles. By the time we get to management level, we're at just over a third, so 35%. And then by the time we get to C-suite, we're at a quarter. So we're going from half to a third to a quarter. And that tells you very clearly that there are these systemic structural barriers that women are facing as they advance through their careers. One of the really helpful things about LinkedIn's data is that, as you say, Mandy, not only does it help us diagnose what the problems are, it can also point us to some of the solutions. And two specific areas where the data shows this is where we need to focus our intervention and our efforts is one, when it comes to internal promotions, and two, when it comes to ensuring that men and women are getting access to equal training and equal mentorship. So, for example, the data shows very clearly that when it comes to internal promotions, men are fully one third more likely than women to get an internal promotion.
Why is that?
Typically, what it's coming down to is hiring practices internally within an organization. And so what's really important is that organizations are at that, specifically at that pre-manager role. That's where we see the first big dip about that slump. That first big dip comes at that pre-manager level. Ensuring that the hiring practices, balanced interview panels, balanced candidate slates, are an unconscious bias training is in place at that stage of that pre-manager level is where we need to start to get to grips with that big gap, as you say, that we see in the middle.
Mm. So what led me to this was you had an article in the Irish Times that did talk about the place, the role that women can play, in particular in relation to AI and the type of skills that are needed there. So I'll come to that in a second. But just on the wider point for a second, we're at full employment in this country, right? So how can we do more to remove those obstacles that you talk about? One of the things you were talking about in this article was the difference between focusing less on degrees and exams and focusing more on skills and experience.
That's right. Taking what we call a skills-based approach to hiring, which means first and foremost, zooming in on that fundamental question of, does this candidate have the skills and potential to do this job? And not focusing exclusively on, did this candidate go to the right school or does this candidate have the right degree? Will do two very material things. Firstly, it will very significantly expand your talent pool.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing it will do is open up that talent pool to populations who've historically been overlooked, including women.
Mm.
And especially when it comes to those roles where women are typically underrepresented. There, if we take the skills-based approach to hiring, we will see a big surge in women coming into those talent pools.
That would be a huge shift for a lot of corporates who start off with, you must have 5 years experience at such or yeah. X degree.
Yeah.
You know, so it would require a big cultural shift or corporate shift in a lot of companies.
And what's so great is we're starting to see that shift happen. So on LinkedIn today, almost half of recruiters who are going on our platform to find talent are looking through the prism of skills. So because we have, precisely because we have that tight labor market, because a lot of economies are at or close to full employment, what we're seeing is companies looking at different ways of accessing talent. And one of those ways is this skills-based approach. So I think there is a lot of encouraging signs coming through, particularly that shift to skills-based hiring, what it's going to do for women and their ability to access opportunities that have been closed to them historically.
Now, Sue, we're all AI'd out the door now. But when I saw a good headline that was positive about AI, I thought, yeah. So in your article, you talk about women on boards being in decline, but how AI could actually help be part of closing the gender gap. Why is that?
There's two key encouraging developments that we're seeing when it comes to women in the labour market and AI. The first is that women are really taking control of this area. They see it coming. They see that it's here, as you say, Mandy. And so they're really upskilling in this space. In the past couple of years, we've seen a doubling in the concentration of women in AI engineering specifically. And more generally, when it comes to AI talent, women are really increasing their share of that part of the workforce. So here in Ireland, they've gone from 24% to 28% of AI talent in the past couple of years.
Probably could have had a lot to do with a lot of the universities here encouraging STEM over the last 10 years.
We have a really strong base here. We've put in place really strong foundations. We need to build on that and ensure that women are accessing these opportunities and advancing in their careers in that space. And the second key area is when it comes to those softer skills. And they are going to be absolutely crucial in the workplace as we move into this AI-driven world of work.
And just remind us what the soft skills are.
They're those uniquely human skills, teamwork, collaboration, communication, leadership that we're talking about today. And there we see that women typically excel at those skills. So here in Ireland, we see that women have a 32% higher share of soft skills on LinkedIn than men. And therefore, their ability to set up for success in this new world of work, to embrace this technology, leverage those unique human skills that they have and excel at, is looking very, very promising for women out there.
Well, Sue, it's absolutely fascinating. And if anyone wants to read it, that article was in the Irish Times. But that was Sue Duke, who is country lead for Ireland with LinkedIn. Thank you very much for coming into studio today.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Coming up next, Will Hutton, who is a political doyen of UK politics, will be joining me to give us his take on what to expect in the final days of the UK election. Welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, we're less than a week away from knowing who will be the next UK Prime Minister. If the polls are correct, Labour's Keir Starmer is on course for a massive majority, while the Conservatives are looking at a wipeout where even their leader, Rishi Sunak, might be in danger of losing his seat. Well, I'm delighted to be joined again now by Will Hutton, whose economic and political commentaries have been required reading all through the Blair years and all through his editorship of The Observer. And of course, he still writes a column there amongst many other things he does in life. Will, you're very welcome back to News Talk.
Thanks. Looking forward to talking to you, Mandy.
Now, I want to talk to you about lots of things. I want to talk about Labour and your book, but I want to start off by where we're at a week out, what the polls are saying, what you think will happen to the Tory party next week. You wrote recently that they're facing a worse outcome than Labour in 2019 and they're not in a good position to recover. Why?
Well, they've misgoverned Britain. I mean, that's as simple as that. There's lots of things going on, actually. I mean, one is just that they are the authors of a kind of economic and social calamity here in the UK. I mean, it's every dial on the kind of dashboard is kind of flashing amber or red, whether it's kind of productivity, whether it's living standards, whether it's growth, whether it's public services, whether it's well-being, whether it's kind of child poverty, everything, you know, it's kind of, and it's a direct consequence of two things. One, ideological commitment, the idea that all that matters in a good economy and society is giving individuals free rein. And they will choose, as long as they're not taxed or regulated, and they will self-organize to best outcomes. You know, just keep the state as minimal as possible. And they visited a series of catastrophes on Britain. I mean, not least of which Brexit, the Liz Truss budget, austerity, all have their roots in that ideology. And secondly, partly because they are, they see themselves as a natural party of government. And they've become, there's a tremendous sense of entitlement about which is personified with people like Boris Johnson and the way they behave during Partygate. And people are saying, you know, we don't want to be governed by these people. They don't really care about kind of the lives of ordinary people. And they make consistent and disastrous policy mistakes. Let's give the others a go. And I think it's as simple as that. And the first past the post voting system kind of magnifies the impact of that. It may be not as bad as some of the polls are suggesting, but I suspect it could be as bad or not worse, if not worse.
Mm. Well, look, we could talk about all the scandals that have erupted during the campaign, but I think we've wasted enough time talking about the Tories on this programme. So I just want to turn to the future and kind of look at what might happen next Friday, and particularly with Keir Starmer. He has adopted this Ming Vaz strategy for the last number of years, and he is way ahead in the polls now. Look, he's no Tony Blair or Boris Johnson, thank God. But has he gone forward or backwards in the campaign, in your view?
That is a really interesting question, forward or backwards in the campaign. Probably about the same, I think. He's held his position. I mean, he has not, despite severe provocation, promised that there'll be no increase in taxes whatsoever. He's just said the big three, value-added tax, income tax, and national insurance, which raise about £7 every 10 of tax revenue. He said he's not going to, no increases there. But he's left the door open, despite extreme provocation, for tax rises elsewhere, which he will need.
Mm.
But elsewhere, he's just been doggedly, you know, saying, you know, time for a change, turn over the page. He's talked about his five missions. He hasn't put any flesh on those five missions. Our listeners are familiar with the five missions, or shall I spell them out?
Yeah, no, you can spell them out for us. We've been keeping an eye on the campaign, but it's worth going over.
I felt a slight groan as I said. If there's one thing I don't want, it's Will Hutton talking about Keir Starmer's five missions. The audience is going to fall off a cliff very, very, very quickly. Mission one is for Britain to have the highest growth rate in the G7. So mission two is net zero by 2030. Mission three is solving the health services problems. Mission four is education opportunity for all. And mission five is safe streets.
Mm.
And he's going to organise the British government, not around departments, but around achievement of those missions.
Yeah,
that's quite a big deal.
And some of the
ambition in there, I mean, it may be baby steps at the beginning, but some of the ambition is very real.
One of the reasons why I did want you to spell out all five is because I want to start talking about your book, and I want to try and do some comparisons with what your book says and some of the stuff that we're hearing from Keir Starmer at the moment. So many listeners may be aware of your book that was very famous, The State We're In. It was in the 1990s and was sort of knocking around like a manifesto. Your new book is called This Time, No Mistakes, How to Make Remake Britain. The title sounds to me, at least, a little bit more optimistic than we're used to from you, but it also sounds like a bit of a threat, you know? And in the first part of the book, it does set out how stark the situation is for Britain at the moment. But as you go through it, there's a few messages that I'm hearing from Keir Starmer at the moment which sound very familiar. So maybe start us off with what was your intent in writing this book? What were you trying to do with it?
Well, I mean, it's summer 2022 and the Liz Truss is about to be elected Labour Tory leader. And I think it's going to be a fiasco, and it was a fiasco. And I just thought, I'm not gagging to write a book, but we can't go on like this. It's this party with their sense of entitlement making terrible mistakes of this type and imposing such privations on people have to be challenged. So I thought, you know, one thing I can do is write. So, you know, I'll do that. I wanted to set out the mistakes the Tories have made, from monetarism through to the Liz Truss budget, but also the mistakes that the liberal left have made in kind of giving them the space to make those mistakes by not having a coherent philosophy of their own. So this time, no mistakes, actually, it's such a plague on both your houses, and saying there is a workable a political philosophy to hand. It is to marry ideas of fellowship, mutuality, having each other's backs, an ethic of socialism with progressive liberalism. You know, that actually, yes, we're agents. We have individual agency and individual ambitions as human beings, but we recognize obligation to society. And you marry those two philosophies and you have quite an interesting kind of, the alchemy produces quite an interesting policy mix. And the great reforming governments in Britain have been ones that have done that, 45-51 Labour government, the Liberal government in 1906 to 1914. So I wanted to say, this time no mistakes on the right, come on, be gone. Mm. But on the left, this time no mistakes, for Christ's sake, this time round, you know, don't either collapse back into kind of timid versions of, you know, Toryism, kind of like the worst of Tony Blair, nor, you know, the excesses of Jeremy Corbyn and others. I mean, just have your, just make that philosophy that I've just adumbrated work. A wee society kind of is what I argue for. Mm. And above all, that's right, investment, investment, investment. So that's as simple as that.
Yeah. So you're sending out this high vision. It's called ethical socialism with progressive liberalism. It's basically, it's the need to generate wealth so that we can foster enough businesses to pay for the services that you need to help get Britain back on its feet, which is remarkably like Keir Starmer's first of his five steps, which is we need to generate growth. Okay. But that high vision that you have, like, how tangible is that as a political offering for someone like Starmer? Because he's got to appeal to the ordinary voter. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. I'm just saying it's very lofty. It's very laudable. But is it enough for him? Maybe he can do this because he's got such a lead in the polls right now. But at some point, he's going to have to start putting meat on the bones of what he's doing.
Well, what I talk about, you know, that highfalutin language of ethical socialism and progressive liberalism, it's really very simple. You know, a good society in the Republic of Ireland, as in the United Kingdom, is actually about creating a minimum social floor below which no one can fall. And simultaneously, ladders of opportunity at which people can climb, even while they recognize their obligations to the society of which they're part. It's as simple as that. It's really simple Simon stuff. And most people are going to buy it. Can Starmer do it? Well, look, I talked to him and I talked to Rachel Reeves and I try and persuade them that they can. And I try and offer them a suite of policies which I think is feasible even in the conditions of today. And actually, I mean, Keir Starmer came along to the launch of the book and told the audience, 700 people, it was a brilliant book and everyone should read it, you know. And I think he seemed to me, at least, or he gave an impression having read it, whether he had read it or not, I have no idea. But he gave an impression having read it. And of course, the big thing is to get, is to spearhead economic recovery by launching a big public investment program. And you do that on levelling up. You do that through net zero. You do that through R&D. You do that through infrastructure. You do that through the institutions that the country's got, which could be vastly boosted, like the UK Infrastructure Bank. You do it through public borrowing, and the financial markets will live with that because they believe in this agenda, actually, and they'll allow you to do it. You have to refashion the financial system so that the companies that you want to take advantage of the opportunities that you're creating have got the wherewithal to do it. And you also want them to be more public-spirited. I mean, you want them to have a great purpose, be animated by a great purpose that actually from which they'll make money rather than to put kind of profit, first and foremost. You put those things together, you will get a kind of dynamic economy, an economy with much more kind of tech companies going growing very rapidly. And you can use the wherewithal to plug the alarming kind of social gaps in Britain's kind of society. So there you are. That's you know, the heart of the book.
Well, I did actually watch that launch, sad and all as I am. And if all 700 people bought the book that night, at least...
You watched the launch?
I did. And at least you will have outsold...
Mandy, you are.
I know.
You're a hero.
No, I need to get out more is what I do. But if all 700 people, you'll have outsold Liz Truss already. Anyway, moving swiftly along, I want to ask you about Brexit because it reminds me of that episode of Fawlty Towers, you know, where nobody mentioned the war. I mentioned it once, but I think I got away with it. Starmer, obviously, in the longer term, wants to reset the relationship with the EU. What do you think he'll do? What will be his first start down that road? Because, you know, obviously it's not been part of the campaign and it won't be. What will he do when he gets in to start rebuilding or repairing or, you know, even re-engaging with the EU properly?
Well, first of all, he will host the European political community conference at Blenheim Palace in Oxfordshire on July weekend of July the 10th, 11th, at which your Taoiseach will be at. And he will glad hand everyone. He will say how keen he is on Europe and must have stable relationships. He'll do three things, I think. One, he will look to make the trade and the trade and cooperation agreement between the EU and the UK operationalize it much more. I mean, we want to, you know, there are mechanisms to have kind of dialogue with the EU and with parliaments as well and civil society, which were established by the trade and cooperation agreement, which the Tory government have just let kind of done nothing with. Mm. So you can breathe life into all of that. And you can start to say, look, you know, we want to be friends. You know, can we cut some deals? And what's happening in France may make other EU states more willing to talk about this than they might otherwise have been, in the sense that, you know, if the French are going to be run by the far right, their willingness to stand up to Russian aggression in Ukraine may be kind of less. So the only other kind of nuclear power in Europe that you can look to is Britain. Mm. And that Britain would like to kind of be the heart of a big, baggy European defence and security pact.
Interesting.
So that, and we want to negotiate that in the next 6 months. I mean, insiders in the Labour team tell me that they've already got some kind of good initial reactions to proposal from a number of European capitals. And it would include not just defence procurement and military cooperation, all the rest of it. It would also be about food security, energy security, data security, cyber security, kind of taking on, you know, Russian hackers. And so in all those areas of the economy, you know, food, energy, data, Britain would have to be in the single market and it would have to comply with EU regulations in order to make the defence pact work.
But a less controversial kind of segue into that relationship rebuilding than maybe some of the other economic...
Absolutely. And nobody in Britain is going to say no to that.
No.
Third thing is to join as a cousin to the European political community, the European environmental community, and to get British environmental standards and institutions and regulations working in parallel with our friends in Europe. You do those three things, you know, you can get quite close to Europe, I think, in ways which most people in Europe would feel comfortable with and most people in Britain would feel comfortable.
And that's the most important thing, that most people in the UK will feel comfortable with it, I guess. Well, look, there's lots more we could talk about and hopefully we'll get you back after the election to see what you make of all of the results. Well, that was Will Hutton, whose new book is called This Time, No Mistakes, How to Remake Britain. Will is, of course, columnist with The Observer and former editor. Thank you so much for being with us again today.
Manny, thank you very much.
You want to be in charge, but you've got nothing to say to people about what you would do about it. This election is about the future.
It's not just a border security issue, it's actually a national security issue because the government's lost control of who's coming and what their background is.
You're going to sit down with the Iranian Ayatollahs? Are you going to try and do a deal with the Taliban? It's completely nonsensical what you are saying. Do not surrender our borders to Keir Starmer. Do not surrender your finances to their tax rights.
And fabricating a difference here in a situation where actually we should be trying to find common ground and work together.
I understand why you're frustrated with our party, with me. I get it. And if you are not certain about Labour, don't surrender to them. Don't vote for any other party. Vote Conservative.
If you want to end 14 years of chaos and rebuild our country, then that power is in your hands. On July the 4th, vote change, vote Labour.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Coming up next, Cliff Taylor from the Irish Times talks about what's in the in tray for Minister Jack Chambers as he becomes the youngest person to take charge of the purse strings at Merrion Street. You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, following on from his promotion to deputy leader of Fianna Fáil last week, this week, Jack Chambers was named as the new Minister for Finance, replacing Michael McGrath, who's been confirmed as Ireland's nominee for the European Commission. So, what are the main economic issues that are facing him as he takes one of the most demanding portfolios in government? Well, who better to tell us all but Cliff Taylor, writer and managing editor of the Irish Times. Cliff, you're very welcome back to Taking Stock.
Thanks, Mandy.
Now, Minister for Finance is a huge step up for anyone taking it on, but someone who's only held a Minister of State role before, this must come with even more pressure given the stage we're at in the political cycle, really, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I guess it's a huge vote of confidence by his party leader, Micheál Martin, who's obviously very impressed with Jack Chambers in his record as a junior minister, and I think in his record in regard to organising the recent local elections for the party. But it's a huge step up, as you say, for anybody, and particularly for somebody who hasn't had a senior ministerial post before.
Mm.
And the timing could hardly be more crucial. I suppose there's the political factor, as you say yourself, general election in the wind. This will certainly be the October budget, will certainly be the last one for this government. And in a mere couple of weeks, the government, the minister, the new minister, and along with Public Spending Minister Pascal Donoghue, have to publish what's called the Summer Economic Statement, which basically is the framework for the budget, gives an indication of how much will be given away in extra spending and tax cuts, roughly what the breakdown between the two might be. And obviously this is really high stakes stuff with the general election in the offing.
Mm.
And a lot of pressure from everywhere for more spending, tax cuts, et cetera, et cetera. Hints already dropped all over the place by outgoing Minister Tánaiste, pretty much any other minister you want to talk about. So
yeah, and it's only going to get a lot worse over the summer. But as you say, the first thing on his desk is finalising that summer economic statement with Pascal Donoghue. And I think sometimes people don't understand the split within the Department of Finance that exists now when it comes to budget, because years ago it used to be on one person's shoulders, but you know, over the years that's changed. So maybe just tell us what Pascal is responsible for and what Jack is going to be responsible for.
Yeah, I suppose, long story short, in terms of the budget, Jack Chambers is responsible for tax and Pascal Donoghue is responsible for spending.
Hmm.
Now, it's maybe not quite as simple as that, because the Minister for Finance also has a broader responsibility for the public finances, for the targets that are set, for how much is going to be, you know, whether it's a borrowing target or whether the budget's going to be in surplus. But that's his bag as well, and he gets to announce that on budget day, as well as any tax changes.
Mm.
And Pascal Donoghue, as Minister for Public Spending, gets to announce the spending package. So I suppose you're right. I mean, you could argue that a very significant part of the pressure in the run-up to the budget is going to be on Pascal Donoghue rather than on Jack Chambers, because health are already overrunning and be looking for more money. Education will be looking for more money. Welfare will be looking for more money, or social protection, as it's called now. So all the departments are going to be looking for more cash. And that really, I suppose, in the first instance, lands on Pascal Donoghue's desk, though he must also, with Jack Chambers, agree an overall budgetary approach, the extent to which the budget is going to be in surplus next year, and so on. And then it's up to, you know, in terms of the detail of the budget, the bit for Jack Chambers then is to decide and announce what happens in income tax and the wider tax area. He has been talking about that in his kind of first comments around the place, not really saying anything very surprising, saying, look, we want to be able to give some kind of an income tax package to families, but we'd have to be cautious. I think a reasonable thing to say for a person in his first couple of days in the department, but doesn't really give us much hint.
No, and
Things might be going.
And as you say, like the summer economic statement will set out, like basically, the basic ground rule for how much they have to spend on that tax package. And we spoke at length about it last summer, and then they ignored all the rules. Absolutely. And the constraints. But just on the tax thing alone, if you just take the tax thing alone, so the Fine Gael want several different tax changes, and they haven't been shy about it. We've heard Simon Harris is working on something like this in the background, but they're already talking about VAT, capital gains tax, change on the USC, which I think Fianna Fáil are also talking about, and now inheritance tax. So it's a heady mix for Jack Chambers, isn't it?
It's, yeah. I think the budget's probably been spent a few times over already, Mandy, to be honest with you. But you're right. I suppose if we read it back, what can we be pretty sure is going to happen? But first of all, there's certainly going to be an income tax package. Michael McGrath said that. Simon Harris has said that. The new minister is only a couple of days in the office. He said that. And we have to remember, I suppose, when we think about an income tax package, that some changes are needed if tax is not to take a greater proportion of people's wages as wages go up. And of course, wages have been going up over the last few years because inflation has been high. So there's going to be adjustments to the tax credits. There's going to be adjustments to the USC, I think, pretty certainly, because that is really the only way to direct significant help at lower income people. And there's going to also be an adjustment to the rate at which people enter the higher tax rate. So they're going to be, I think, three nailed on things. And the thing to look for there will be the extent to which those changes are ahead of inflation, the extent to which they are real giveaways. Very hard to know that yet. But there's a general election coming up, and yourself, they're likely, if there's an extra mile to be gone, I think
this is the year they might do it.
It may be gone.
Yeah.
With all the caveats thrown in about being cautious and prudent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it's hard to know what's going to be harder to resist, the spending splurge or the tax pressures. And I think we're going to have a summer of speculation. But look, Chambers is going to obviously be under a lot of pressure to see the VAT rate reduced from 13.5% back down to 9%. We've seen a number of people and groups calling for this. But to do that's very costly, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, I think you're well into the hundreds of millions to do that. And it's been a long story, hasn't it? Reduced down, various deadlines passed before it was pushed back up again. And now huge pressure from retailers and people in the hospitality business in particular. Peter Burke also has been hinting at it since he's moved into enterprise. I think there's a fair chance of it happening, but I wouldn't think it's nailed on, because what's going to happen late in the day is they're going to face a list of seven things, and they can only do four or five of them.
And Cliff,
to see how that lines up. And the Department of Finance, of course, hate it.
Yeah,
and it's a big chunk of revenue that's going to be gone. And I think if it's cut again this time, it's very hard to see it going back up again in reality.
And the poor old Fiscal Advisory Council have been warning and threatening and castigating them for what they've done in the past. But, you say, we're in an election cycle now. So who knows what would happen? Fianna Fáil, in particular, heading into the next general election, the public finances in really good health, steady economic growth. Any idea what Jack Chambers, what his own priorities might be, or what his, leaning is?
I haven't, Mandy, and I've been kind of looking back at what he said before and, talking to people and watching what he said in his first couple of days. And I don't. I think, the context of this is, if you look at last year's budget, the Fine Gael ministers, the junior ministers in their famous op-ed got out early.
I forgot about that.
Then Michael McGrath kind of grabbed onto the USC as his part of the package, if you like, or that was the way it seemed to be presented politically. So I think we've seen hostility start even earlier this year, and everyone trying to grab onto the idea that there's going to be tax credit increases this year, and that the rate at which people enter the higher rates is going to go up to help the middle earners, squeeze middle, et cetera, et cetera. That there's going to be money directed at childcare. And we've seen other things floated into the mix, as you've said, in the last couple of days, such as an increase in, or more relief, if you like, in inheritance tax.
Mm.
The argument being that, you know, people passing on assets to children, the real value of the tax-free allowances in those areas has kind of come down significantly. So there's rumours and leaks that Fine Gael would be looking for an increase there. You might point out that that would go directly against what the Commission on Tax and Welfare had recommended, which is more taxes on wealth and more taxes on inheritance and a tightening of the rules in those areas rather than a loosening of them. But as you say, with the general election coming up, I think a lot of these things are going to be pushed into the background.
Yeah, we could probably do a whole programme on what they need to do vis-a-vis the housing market for both the individual and for developers and all that building stuff. Cliff, before I let you go, just very briefly, we've only talked about what's happening here and the pressures domestically from a political perspective. What about international issues that are going to face Jack Chambers?
Potentially huge, to be honest. I suppose his time in office may be short enough that you know, things are only building up. But we've two really consequential elections for Ireland. I think maybe three in the next few months. First of all, there's the French election, and you know, real fears, I suppose, that could set off a bit of nervousness in the markets. Because of the plans of the both the right and the left in terms of the public finances and the kind of uncosted promises that are being made by both sides, so that is a concern, in the sense that it, you know, if it starts a bit of a rumble in the Eurozone again, that's going to make things more difficult for everybody. Fortunately, Ireland's got a bit of leeway in its public finances, but not good news, I think, albeit that it may take a while to play out, because it looks like it may be, you know, it may end in some kind of a stalemate there in the short term at least. Then we've the UK election, you know, the possibility of, I suppose, of better news there with Labour getting in and a bit more stability in the relationship with the UK and maybe working on issues there a little more calmly. But then the big one, of course, in America is Trump, and really the unpredictable impact of his trade policies, in particular promises of tariffs, promises of a crackdown on trade with China, which is happening to some extent, of course, under the current presidency. And if you consider that Ireland is that kind of sits in the middle with a lot of the companies, American companies here, have links to China in various ways. For example, you know, that's where a lot of the Apple phones are made. Intel exported a lot of their chips to China and, you know, have been stopped from doing so to some extent by new rules that the Biden administration has brought in. So there's a lot going on there, and I think a considerable fear of what a Trump presidency might bring if that is, in fact, what emerges in November.
Lots of good advice for the new Minister for Finance, Cliff, from you there. Let's hope.
Documents from the civil servants playing things up to try and get the new minister to keep some kind of a rein on things in the budget package.
Well, let's hope he's listening, Cliff. That was Cliff Taylor, Managing Editor of the Irish Times. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Mandy.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. While we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the News Talk app. Thank you to all of today's guests, to Will Hutton, to Cliff Taylor and Sue Duke. Thanks also to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy. Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt were on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Now, sadly, we lost two titans of Irish broadcasting and journalism this week, Micheál Omar-Herthy and Tommy Gorman. I am very privileged and proud to be able to call Tommy one of my close personal friends, and he will long be remembered as a remarkable man and a friend to so many. Despite Tommy's very busy life, he always managed to listen to this programme every single week, and he was always a great supporter of mine throughout my career. We worked alongside each other for many, many years, and he was a great friend to me personally. So from everyone here at News Talk, our deepest sympathies and prayers are with his beloved Kira, Joe and Moya. Arieshje Gorau Anam Dilish. And to finish out today, here's Tommy with his take on what happened in the local and European elections just a couple of weeks ago here on Taking Stock.
It was a huge success of an election for the government and for Simon Harris in particular. There was a sugar hit effect of the Harris presence. Sinn Féin had a disaster of an election, nothing short of a disaster. I think the lesson for them is there are enough people out there angry. The electorate is angry. There are very angry options available to voters. But people want policies and they want hope as well as anger. And I think Sinn Féin is going to have to reflect on that. A factor you have to take into account with European elections is they're almost like the Eurovision Song Contest. And name recognition is very important. And say, for instance, the constituency that I live in, it's 13 counties, absolutely huge. So it was people who had, say, good postering, like, say, Maria Walsh. The Carberry factor was there, somebody who's known. The Mullooly factor, the fellow off the telly, that figures. I think that celeb factor does figure in European elections in a way that wouldn't translate into a general election. It's just going to be a bare-knuckle contest right up to the next general election.